Michael Buck, let's talk about your introduction to commercial radio. When did commercial radio first come into your mind?
Well, it came into my mind about 3 years before it came into the mind of the then Home Secretary, because I went to Jamaica at the age of 25 to run the Jamaican Broadcasting Corporation as programme director, and it was a commercial radio station, which is where I really learnt about commercial radio. Because when I got there, I found I knew nothing about commercial radio. There hadn't been any in Britain. I'd been working on the Light Programme and the Home Service, you see, which wasn't much of a guide. And so I took myself off to Miami, which in those days was the third biggest market in the States. And I immersed myself in it for about 6 or 8 weeks. I mean, going around stations, sitting in libraries, watching how jocks worked, looking at making commercials. And I came back and we rebuilt the JBC. And when I came back to England, I went back into television and was editor of 24 Hours for a while, and then editor of the BBC's moonshot programmes and stuff like that. But then I got an offer, because I was the only person they could find who knew about commercial radio, to join John Whitney's consortium, which turned out in the end to be Capital.
And then doing the job as programme controller... You got some background, you got some ideas, but was that an easy thing, bringing that
team
together?
It was totally wonderful and exciting, because it was a tabula rasa, it was an empty space. We could do what we liked, I mean, within the IBA's, as it was then's limits. And we did all kinds of things. I mean, we did a live soap opera, for example, whereby the script was written every morning to fit in with the news. The people we had on board were extraordinary. We had, you know, we had Aspel and Everett, we had Roger Scott, we had Nicky Horn, who used to be Emperor Roscoe's roadie. Did you know that? I mean, Roscoe must have been scraping the barrel. I mean, Nicky's only about 3'6". I mean, for him to be a roadie is beyond contemplation. But anyway, I rescued him from that. And we had amazing ladies too: Marsha Hunt, Joan Shenton, Sue Cook, all sorts of people. We had the first woman newsreader ever, Sue Denny, her name was, who was the first woman newsreader on British radio at all, and she did breakfast news as well, not just sort of buried in the thing. So we did a whole lot of Simon Jenkins was our political editor. I mean, we did all kinds of fantastic things, and it was a wonderful time. We could break every rule there had been.
Sounds like great fun.
It was. This is one of the things. There's nothing legal you can do that you can earn money at, right, that's half as much fun as running a radio station.
But they were quite difficult times in some ways, weren't they? Because people didn't really understand commercial radio.
Well, it wasn't that. We got the 3-day week and the miners' strike within 4 months of starting. So you couldn't give the stuff away. I mean, people forget this. Production was down to 3 days a week. I walked down Oxford Street on Christmas Eve that year, and Selfridges was lit by candles because the power was off. And, I mean, no money came in at all for nearly 4 months, and the thing was a catastrophe. Not because it wasn't working as radio, people always forget that. It was because the country was on its knees economically. And we went through 2 general elections in 6 months and all of that stuff. Afterwards, it came very good and was wonderful. But there was a rough old time. Yes, there was a rough old time, my God.
But you got through it and still it demonstrated there was an audience for commercial radio.
Well, when I left Capital, it was number one in London. You can't say more than that. Toughest market in the world.
let's go beyond that and let's talk about the National Broadcasting School, which was
It was a wonderful organisation. It came out of a thing called secondary rental. Do you remember secondary rental? It was the idea was that no radio station should be allowed to make a disgusting amount of money. Therefore, the minute it made more than 5% of its turnover as profit, half of everything else had to go to what was called secondary rental. That had education or the arts. And with places like Capital making more money than a horse has hair, right? It was sloshing about in the IBA's coffers. So they decided to set up a National Broadcasting School, and it was for 6 years until the IBA itself was changed and lost control of radio and became 2 separate organisations, and secondary rental was cancelled. It did a lot of good. Something like 3,000 people went through its doors. It was validated as the one of the earliest journalistic organisations to teach radio. And half the programme controllers in the country now are graduates, which is really nice.
Mm.
Pity there's nothing there now.
Indeed. But have all these other academic institutions, they seem to have taken over. I mean, I understand there are 30,000 students doing media courses these days.
What a nightmare. No, nothing wrong with that. I mean, some of the best people in broadcasting I know have done media courses, and some of the best have never been near a university. So, I mean, it's six of one and half a dozen of the other. I think that media courses and the National Broadcasting School were very different. Media courses were academically orientated, and still are, and quite rightly, because that's what universities do, is they give degrees. The school was interested in the theory only insofar as it impinged on the practice. And that's a very different approach. The theory is hugely important. I mean, if you don't know libel and you're a journalist, for example, I mean, you're dead in the water, or your station is very shortly, and it's insurance policy. But the fact remains that you only learn the law in that context to suit you for being a better or a more competent journalist, reporter, or editor. Whereas in other places, you might do whole courses on the interaction of the law and journalism, you know, and write essays about it. There were no essays at the National Broadcasting School.
Just successful programmers.
Well, lots of them, thank God. Yes, and engineers and television people. We did television as well for the IT, for the what was it then, the IBA, now the ITCA or whatever.
During that time, your services were called upon to help with one or two problematic stations. And
yes, I was asked by the IBA to turn two or three stations, see if we could turn two or three stations around. We managed quite well. Cardiff was one example of that. It was non-existent at the time, virtually, and we turned it round. They also had some luck. I think luck, people say, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get. Well, I just don't believe that. If I hadn't had unbelievable amounts of luck in all sorts of ways, no matter, I know lots of people work harder than I do and haven't had the good fortune. They had snow that winter. The station turned round, got itself sorted out, and Cardiff had a three-day snowstorm. And they did the business, and from that day onwards, they owned Cardiff, because they'd served the community. Those kinds of opportunities to serve can really make a huge difference to a local radio station.
Then, getting involved with the GWR group as program director for the group, you had a whole clutch of radio stations.
Yeah, I had 12. I was, well, don't laugh, there are people now responsible for 25. How they even get round them, I don't know, because I used to spend more time in my... Cars are great, though, because if you're driving somewhere, you can listen to the station, and as you move from one station's patch to the other, so you switch over, so you're never wasting time. But I was involved with the move to split the frequencies. You know, the AM and FM frequencies until then had been simulcast. So I was involved, really, with creating GWR's AM services, as well as running the FM ones. So that was a very interesting time, because it was a time of really looking at audiences and seeing what differentiation and segmentation could take place. Now it's got a lot more segmented, but it was at that time the first time anyone in this country was looking at it in that sort of detail. I mean, Capital was as well, but we were the second group, as it were, to move in that direction.
Do you enjoy that?
Yes, I did. I have a deep and sort of very... old-fashioned commitment to broadcasting. I'm not a narrowcaster by nature. I'm of the opinion if you don't want to talk to the multitude, you ought to get off the mountain. So I really quite like full-service radio stations. I had the great gift given to me of being able to run one again, a station that set out to act to provide everything that a listener could reasonably need, which was a great blessing.
Do you fear that's being lost in commercial radio?
No, I think not. I think there are a number of people who are very committed to broad-based radio. Fortunately, the two front runners, I suppose, in some ways, in the business, the national station, Classic, remains a full-service station. You know, it has a world-class and prize-winning news service. It doesn't just play the music, although it does that well. It also has a whole lot of involvement at kind of charitable levels and at community service levels, which is part of the business. And the reason why Capital still owns London, despite everyone else scrabbling around in the dust, is because Capital puts back into its audience what it takes out. It still does Help a London Child. They raise £1 million a time. You know, it still does Flat Share. It still does the Job Finder things. It does all of those things that make it a service for the people. It does good news, great sport. I mean, that's a full-service radio station, and I still think a great full-service radio station knocks spots off any narrowcaster.
going back then to the origins, the birth of classic, your baby.
1975, I was asked by the AN-AN committee to write a report on the future of local and commercial radio. And I put at the top of the list a FM popular classical music station, 1975. Am I actually on record in a governmental department? So I've been chasing that for 22 years, and it was a wonderful opportunity to do it, but nobody believed at the time it was going to work.
But it did.
It did, thank God. Yes, it worked because it was what fundamentally good radio is: listener radio, not broadcaster radio. Right? I say to people, good radio starts with the audience. It doesn't start with what you want to do. That may sound facile, but it's fundamentally true. Audiences don't change what they do so they can listen to the radio. When you get up in the morning, you know, whatever your pattern is, you clean your teeth, you have a bath, you eat breakfast, you're not going to change any of that to listen to the radio. So the radio's got to fit that. It's got to fit your needs and style. It's got to be in accessible chunks. It's got to have enough news, but not too much. It's got to tell you what you need to know about the weather or the trains or whatever. You've got to do all of that properly, at the same time as entertaining and enlivening you. Now, that's listener-orientated radio, LOR, rather than broadcast-orientated radio, which is bore.
The secret of success is always the listener, whatever you're doing.
I think if you don't want to serve the listener, you want to be in broadcasting. I mean, broadcasting is a great privilege, right? Whatever we all say about it, and we moan and we bitch and we complain, broadcasting is a great privilege. You've got a chance to talk to the whole world if you can persuade them to listen to you. And that gives you huge power and enormous responsibilities, it seems to me. And they go together. You can't have the power without responsibilities. And if you try to, then I think you're fundamentally flawed. And one of the great things about that means that you have to address yourself to making the world a better place if you can. That may be a very brief moment of happiness for somebody, or it may be a very fundamental approach to journalism, which is that telling the truth and investigation is hugely important because it's one of the balances that prevents corrupt government. And all. I mean, you can do it in a great, deep, philosophical way, or you could do it in a light-hearted, that song really gave me a lift this morning way. But all in all of it's got to serve the listener. Otherwise, what's it for?
What, looking back over the 25 years, what do you think the contribution to British broadcasting, commercial radio has given? What has been commercial radio?
It's transformed it. It's now the number one choice in its very myriad forms for all radio listening. And I think the idea that license fee paid radio is public service and the other is not is fundamentally flawed. There's publicly paid for radio and it's commercially paid for radio, but both are public services. If 52% of the population every day isn't serving the public, please explain the words.
What of the next 25 years?
Well, I think that's going to be a really extraordinary time. I'm not sure that the technology is going to make that much difference. I think for most people, radio is a friend that comes out of a box on the fridge or by the bed, right? And mostly, they don't really care whether it's being transmitted via Mars or coming down a pipe, you know, underground. So there's a real danger of us getting carried away by all of that. I think better reception always helps, which is why FM's taken over from AM, and I've no doubt that digital in due course will take over from FM. But people really are interested in the human being in the box and what he or she's got to say and what he or she's got to play. In the end, that's what matters, and that's the thing I hold on to, that it doesn't matter what the technology does. In the end, the human being in the box is going to make the difference, and that, for me at least, is a great comfort.